This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Do you trust television news? Okay, thanks. Can I ask you a quick question? Can I ask you a quick question? Yes or no question?
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 1st, 2006, and this is a KABU Morning News. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
Coming up on this program, the U.S. Forest Service says it will soon auction off old-growth timber in the roadless area damaged by the Biscuit Fire. A lawsuit was filed in Portland asking the federal court to shut down electronic spying by the NSA. In a recent poll of almost 1,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, finds that 72% think all troops should be withdrawn this year. Weather for Portland and the surrounding areas calls for showers with temperatures in the low 50s.
The Oregon Department of Transportation launches its mileage fee pilot project in Portland area this week with the recruitment of volunteers for the program. Administered by ODOT's Office of Initiative of Innovative Partnership, the mileage fee pilot project will test several key aspects of charging a per mile fee at the pump in lieu of paying the state gas tax. Volunteers for the 1 year pilot will use a mileage counting device for in-state travel and will need to purchase gas at select service stations in northeast and southeast Portland. The mileage fee pilot project is the result of research findings from Oregon's Road User Fee Task Force, or RUF, created by the Oregon Legislature in 2001 to investigate new ways of generating revenue for the state's transportation system. Oregon, like many other states and nations, is experiencing a decline in gas tax revenue due to increased automobile fuel efficiency. A mileage fee is one proposal for replacing gas tax revenues for road maintenance, preservation, and construction. This from the Medford News.
Landmark bipartisan county payments legislation authored by U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Larry Craig of Idaho was lauded in a new report released yesterday by the Sierra Institute for Community and Environment. The report also recommended that the Wyden-Craig legislation be renewed before it expires later this year. Wyden said today's report by the Sierra Institute highlights the significant community development that occurred nationwide because of this law. Environmentalists have all come together on a range of environmental issues to ensure funding for rural communities, and we've seen that this collaborative approach works, which is why the law should be renewed. The report, funded by the United States Forest Service, examines the impact of resource advisory committees, or RAC, groups designed to ensure expanded economic activity and forest restoration in the communities that take part in this program. The RACs are made up of local officials, environmentalists, and timber interests. While these are groups that may not always agree, the report found that in the areas where they developed projects by consensus and were approved by the RACs, the relationship between the various factions in the communities improved. The report executive summary also notes, no RAC project has been applied to an agency or challenged in a court of law. This from the Medford News.
U.S. Forest Service officials say they will soon auction timber from undeveloped roadless areas burned in the 2002 Biscuit Fire. Biscuit logging projects until now have avoided the roadless lands, focusing instead on less contested acreage designated for commercial cutting and older forest reserves. A spokeswoman for Governor Kulongoski said he had asked the Bush administration to keep loggers out of the Biscuit's roadless areas and will urge the Forest Service to hold off on its roadless cutting. The Forest Service plans two timber sales this spring in the roadless areas. A forest ecologist with the World Wildlife Fund in Ashland said the government is unlikely to make enough money on the logging to pay its way, adding that it's expensive to get in there and it's damaging to the regenerative qualities of the ecosystem. And the area is a stronghold of fisheries in southwest Oregon. A report published in Science magazine by an OSU student last month showed that a forest recovers faster after a fire if left alone and not logged, by Bush administration claims. The Bush administration last year opened roadless areas to logging under certain conditions after they had been put off limits by the Clinton administration. Four western states and several environmental groups are challenging the new roadless policy in federal court. Environmentalists and many scientists argue that roadless areas offer a prime source of clean water and the best habitat for fish and wildlife.
A lawsuit filed in Portland yesterday asked a federal court to shut down electronic surveillance by the National Security Agency, or NSA, based on claims that the NSA illegally wiretapped conversations between the director of an Islamic charity and two of the charity's attorneys. The chapter of Al Haramain's Islamic Foundation, a defunct Saudi Arabian charity, was established in Ashland in 1997 as a prayer house that also distributed Islamic literature. The chapter was indicted in February of 2004 on tax charges alleging it helped launder $150,000 in donations to Chechnya in 2000. Attorneys for the Al Haramain chapter have insisted the money was used only for charities, but federal prosecutors had claimed that in the indictment that the money could have been used to assist Muslim militants. But prosecutors later asked a federal judge to dismiss the charges. The request was granted last September, and over objections of the attorneys for Al Haramain, who wanted the government to show what evidence it had against the charity. The lawsuit alleges the NSA illegally wiretapped electronic communications between the chapter and their attorneys in Washington, D.C. A lawsuit was filed on behalf of the two Washington attorneys and the Al Haramain chapter by three Portland civil rights attorneys.
The House of Representatives will vote tomorrow on a controversial national food uniformity labeling law that will take away local government and states' power to require food safety labels, such as those required in some states on food or beverages that are likely to cause cancer, birth defects, allergic reactions, or mercury poisoning. This from the Organic Consumer Association. This bill would also prevent citizens in local municipalities and states from passing laws requiring that genetically engineered foods and ingredients such as Monsanto's recombinant bovine growth hormone be labeled. The vote for H.R. 4167 is tomorrow. The bill would gut state food safety and labeling laws. The Organic Consumer Association says that National Uniformity for Food Act lowers the bar on food safety by overturning state food safety laws that are not identical to federal law. There are hundreds of state laws and regulations at risk, including those governing the safety of milk, fish, and shellfish. The bill is being pushed by large supermarket chains and food manufacturers, spearheaded by the powerful Grocery Manufacturers of America. If you seek to take action, you can still contact your Congress member in the House of Representatives to vote no on H.R. 4167.
The Supreme Court today will delve into the controversy over a Texas voter redistricting plan promoted by Republicans, preeminently Tom DeLay. The measure led to the 2004 ouster of five Democratic incumbents in Congress and sparked a bitter partisan battle. Underlying the appeals are claims that the Texas congressional map unfairly reduced minority voting strength. However, the justices are more likely to consider narrow legal arguments. The question of whether courts can fashion a proper remedy when partisan gerrymandering is judged excessive will likely be considered. Another question the Supreme Court will take up is whether states can remake their congressional map twice in the same decade when a valid plan exists. But it all comes down to voting districts that are drawn in favor of a political party. The court has the power to declare the current Texas plan unconstitutional and throw it back, either to lower state or federal courts, or to the state legislature to fashion a new congressional map. It is unclear whether a ruling from the court, expected by late June, would affect the November elections. Candidates for Texas congressional seats, including incumbents, have begun campaigning, and the primary is March 7th. With a runoff date April of 11th. But the potential exists that by the time a ruling comes out, general election nominees might be running in districts that no longer exist. Another uncertainty is where the justices may be leaning. The newest members have not heard many such election disputes while serving in appellate court judges.
In Los Angeles, a deputy district attorney said yesterday that the Los Angeles Police Department will need additional funding to deal with the anticipated effects of a ballot initiative that expanded the state's authority to collect DNA samples. KPFK's Kelly Barnes has more.
Proposition 69, approved by a 62% majority in 2004, allows the collection of DNA from all adults and juveniles convicted of felonies and from all adults suspected of murder or certain sex crimes. In 2009, the authority to collect DNA will expand to include those arrested on suspicion of any felony and some misdemeanors. Opponents of Prop 69 said state law already required DNA samples from dangerous felons, and the additional measures only put innocent people's privacy at risk. Once cleared, innocent arrestees can formally request expunging their DNA from the massive state database. A court can deny the request, and that denial under Prop 69 cannot be appealed. Currently, the LAPD collects some 5,000 DNA samples per month, and they expect that number to jump to 6,000 under the new rules. In LA for FSRN, I'm Kelly Barnes of People Without Borders.
According to UPI, scientists could rapidly track potential impacts nanoparticles could have on cells via a new technique employing infrared scans. Materials and devices possessing components only nanometers or billionths of a meter in size are growing more popular in everything from cosmetics to clothing and electronics to pharmaceuticals. But concern is growing among scientists, officials, industry, and the public about the risk of harm or unintended effects nanoparticles could have on health and the environment. The incredibly tiny proportions of these materials can make them behave quite differently from more conventional-sized compounds. Much remains unknown about what biological effects nanomaterials could have. To investigate the damage that the nanoparticles might wreak, material scientist S.K. Sundaram and toxicologist Thomas Weber at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington, are developing a method that scans for all the biological effects a given substance might have on live cells. Not only can this new technique analyze the potential impact of nanoparticles on cells, but any other compounds, for example, new pharmaceuticals, could also use the system to test for toxicity. Much work remains ahead, such as determining the sensitivity, reproducibility, and specificity of the reprocesses these scans can yield.
The Supreme Court dealt a setback yesterday to abortion clinics in a two-decade-old legal fight over anti-abortion protests. The court ruled that federal extortion and racketeering laws cannot be used to ban demonstrations. The 8-0 decision ends a case that the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had kept alive despite a 2003 ruling by the High Court that lifted a nationwide injunction on anti-abortion groups. Anti-abortion groups brought the appeal after the appellate court sought to determine whether the injunction could be supported by charges that protesters had made threats of violence. In yesterday's ruling, Justice Stephen Breyer said Congress did not intend to create a freestanding physical violence offense in the federal extortion law known as the Hobbs Act. Instead, Breyer wrote, Congress chose to address violence outside abortion clinics in 1994 by passing the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which set parameters for such protests. Social activists and the AFL-CIO had sided with abortion demonstrators in arguing that lawsuits and injunctions based on the federal extortion law could be used to thwart their efforts to change public policy or agitate for better wages and working conditions.
According to a study by the National Employment Law Project, over 160,000 Gulf Coast workers left jobless because of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita will lose their unemployment benefits beginning March 4th. Unless Congress issues an extension, Selena Masuto reports from Washington.
According to government statistics, the amount of people from the Gulf Coast region receiving unemployment benefits is going down, but that decrease has nothing to do with more jobs being created. Late last year, state unemployment agencies in the Gulf Coast required people to phone in regular updates in order to continue to receive their benefits, but the call system was overwhelmed by hundreds of thousands of calls, and many were dropped, according to Maurice Emsalem, the policy director for the National Employment Law Project.
Because folks can't get through on the phones, They got to show up in person. Well, people are showing up in person from Memphis, from Houston, from all over the place to get back on benefits. And if you show up in person in New Orleans or Metairie, the offices are closed at 10 o'clock. They can only handle 200 people a day. So the state now is trying to come up with a system. They're starting more call centers to handle the volume, but it's still a huge issue. So you got this huge backlog of people.
On the Senate side of Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana celebrated Mardi Gras with words of caution.
I can tell you that trailers, while they're needed, are not enough. And when the next hurricane season comes, which is here in just a few months, having trailers on the ground in flood-prone areas creates yet another set of challenges for this recovery. So the faster we can get permanent housing in terms of new floodplain maps, new decisions being made, and a real support from the federal government for housing.
Congress will be looking at a $19.8 billion supplemental for Gulf Coast hurricane relief that includes money for housing. Also, the House and Senate FEMA committees approved federal disaster and employment benefit extensions in December and February. However, the House leadership has not placed the extension bill on the floor for a vote. Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
The average American family has taken a financial tumble and millions in the country go hungry, despite President Bush's sunny assessment of the U.S. economy, say federal data and economists. Bush talked up the nation's wealth last week during a speech in Milwaukee. "We're doing fine," he said, and described the economy as strong and gaining steam. According to Bush, economic growth had clocked a respectable 3.5%. Unemployment had been held down to 4.7%, with more than 4 million new jobs created in the past 30 months, and after-tax income had risen 8% since 2001. Within days, however, the Federal Reserve reported that average incomes after adjusting for inflation had actually had fallen between 2001 and 2004. At the same time, the number of Americans who need emergency food aid to survive had swollen to more than 25 million even before Hurricane Katrina and Rita struck. Many families continued to struggle in the wake of the 2000 stock market collapse and 2001 recession.
Across India today, tens of thousands of Muslims and communists took to the streets protesting against a visit of President Bush, this according to Reuters. India is the world's largest democracy and also Asia's third largest economy. About 100,000 Muslims gathered in the heart of the Indian capital shouting anti-Bush slogans. The protesters shouted, "Go back, Bush. Bush is a killer. Bully Bush, buzz off. And stop, Bush, stop the ambush." One man said, "The people of the country do not want this killer of innocent men, women, and children to come here." In the eastern city of Calcutta, about 25,000 communist supporters converged on the city center to take part in a public meeting organized by the Committee Against Bush Visit. Anti-Bush demonstrations are expected to follow the president during his three-day visit.
President George W. Bush flew to New Delhi yesterday as U.S. and Indian negotiators were working to try to reach a nuclear agreement, according to Reuters. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said a key issue was to ensure any agreement that put a nuclear reactor under civilian safeguard did so permanently. As well as trying to salvage a nuclear deal with India, Bush will visit Pakistan to give a boost to a key ally against Al-Qaeda Pakistan, President Pervez Musharraf. It is Bush's first visit to either India or Pakistan. In New Delhi, Bush will promote strengthening U.S. relations with India, whose growing economic might is a source of interest and some concern in the United States because of job outsourcing. Dominating the agenda leading up to the trip was whether the two sides would be able to negotiate a nuclear agreement, but the White House worked in recent days to try to lower expectations. The deal agreed to in principle last July would give India access to long-denied U.S. nuclear equipment and fuel and also allow other nuclear nations to do business with New Delhi. But it hinges on agreement by India to separate its civilian and military nuclear programs and put the civilian reactor under international safeguards.
Reports reveal that the U.S. military has expanded another prison in Afghanistan, where some 500 suspects are kept indefinitely and without charges in harsher conditions than at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay. This from Al Jazeera. The UK's Telegraph says Bagram U.S. secret jail in Afghanistan now stands as a rival to Guantanamo Bay, with hundreds of inmates in legal limbo. Bagram has been discovered in the north of Kabul, where the situation resembles the legal void that led to the Supreme Court ruling in 2004, which gave Guantanamo prisoners the right to challenge their detention in U.S. courts. The prison was never photographed, even from a distance. Most of the detainees held spent more than 2 and 3 years at Bagram, without access to lawyers or the right to hear the allegations for which they're jailed. Only rudimentary reviews of their status as enemy combatants. The Pentagon claims that it worked to better the conditions at Bagram after the violent deaths of two inmates in 2002. However, conditions there remain harsher than at Guantanamo. Bagram has never meant to be a long-term facility, and now it's a long-term facility without the money or resources. Anyone who has been to Bagram would tell you it is worse than Guantanamo Bay, said one Pentagon official who visited the jail. The number of what Bush's administration calls terror suspects held at Bagram's have risen from 100 in early 2004 to 600 at times last year, according to U.S. officials, due to a decision by the Bush administration in 2004 to stop sending more prisoners to Guantanamo.
On his way to India, Bush made a surprise stopover this morning in Afghanistan. Air Force One landed at a U.S. air base outside of Kabul, and the president and his entourage were whisked to the capital in heavily armed helicopters. Bush held a working lunch with Karzai and other Afghan leaders, attended a ribbon-cutting ceremony at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, and spoke to U.S. troops at Bagram Air Base. At a joint news conference with Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai, Bush pledged to stand by the country's emerging democracy despite renewed violence, saying the U.S. will not, quote, cut and run.
A recent Zoghbi poll of 944 U.S. soldiers in Iraq reported that 72% thought all troops should withdraw this year. The views of the troops differ markedly from those of their commander-in-chief and the administration. Only 23% wanted to stay the course. The troops' views, however, concur with those of the foreign policy establishment. There were differences in the Zoghbi poll among the service branches, with the Reserves and National Guard overwhelmingly in favor of withdrawal this year, compared to the Army and Marines. Even more impressively, three-quarters of the Guard and Reserves and half of the Army favored withdrawal within 6 months. Marines were more inclined to stay as long as needed. But only a quarter of the Army and 9% of the Guard and Reserves felt that way. Apparently, Senators Russ Feingold and Representative Jack Murtha knew what they were talking about when they proposed many months ago that the troops had done everything possible and should be leaving Iraq in 2006. The wide-ranging poll also showed that 58% of those serving in country says the U.S. mission in Iraq is clear in their minds, while 42% said it is either somewhat unclear or that they have no understanding of it at all, while 85% said the war is mainly to retaliate for Saddam's role in the 9/11 attacks. 77% said that they also believe the main or major reason for the war was to stop Saddam from protecting al-Qaeda in Iraq, both which have been proven untrue.
The U.S. State Department is winding down its $20 billion reconstruction program in Iraq, and the only new rebuilding money in its latest budget request is for prisons. State Department Iraq Coordinator James Jeffrey told reporters he was asking Congress for $100 million for prisons, but no other big building projects were in the pipeline for the department's 2006 supplemental and 2007 budget requests for Iraq, which totaled just over $4 billion. Eventually, the Iraqis would take more detainees now in the U.S. custody, and more space was needed, Jeffrey said, adding that money would also be set aside to increase the number of prosecutors and corrections advisors. Experts on Iraq reconstruction said it was notable that the only new rebuilding money was for prisons after the public relations disaster caused by the eruption of the scandal at Abu Ghraib prison, where U.S. forces abused Iraqi inmates. The initial goal of the U.S. rebuilding program was to improve the lives of Iraqis by fixing the country's dilapidated infrastructure and polish America's image at the same time.
The U.S. Patriot Act renewal is heading for the Senate approval, even as lawmakers continue to squabble over whether it has enough curbs on government power and terror investigations. Senate Democrats say Republicans have allowed the Bush administration to dictate the finished product. Senator Russ Feingold said that the role of the Senate was not to rubber stamp Republican legislation, and he criticized Democrats for capitulating back in 2001 when the act was rushed into law. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is not allowing amendments to be considered because Congress has extended the deadline twice. Now the act will expire March 10th if not passed by Congress and signed into law by Bush. Republicans said the war on terror can't wait for more debate. The Senate voted 69 to 30 yesterday. 60 votes were needed to limit debate and bring the legislation to a final vote. The Senate is expected to pass the measure as early as today unless Democratic procedural maneuvers derail the train. The House then is expected to approve it and send the bill to Bush's desk next week. Despite the bill's progress, deep misgivings remain even among its chief supporters. Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter yesterday found himself in the paradoxical position of urging his colleagues to pass a bill so flawed that Specter himself planned new legislation and hearings to fix it. He said he plans more legislation and hearings on restoring House-rejected curbs on government power. His bill would make the government satisfy a higher threshold for warrantless wiretaps and would set a 4-year expiration date for the use of national security letters in terrorism investigations.
7 peace activists were arrested yesterday in front of the White House in a civil disobedience protest against the war in Iraq. The activists held a sign that read, "God forgive America." The 7 were charged with the federal misdemeanor of demonstrating without a permit, fined $75, and released yesterday evening. The action was part of Voices for Creative Nonviolence's Winner of Our Discontent demonstrations in the month leading up to the 3rd anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March 20th. The group demonstrated on the sidewalk in front of the White House fence, walking slowly with placards and banners for about 30 minutes. The 7 who were arrested took their signs to the portion of the fence ruled off limits to protest where they stood, attracting the attention of park police who warned them they risked arrest. When they refused to move, police called in a large team to make the arrests. The team included 6 officers on motorcycles, 1 on horseback, and over a dozen in patrol cars and unmarked vehicles, several command officers and 4 Secret Service officers observing.
Across the world, they are coming, the water wars, from Israel to India, from Turkey to Botswana. Arguments are going on over disputed water supplies that may soon burst into open conflict. Yesterday, Britain's Defense Secretary John Reid pointed to the factor hastening the violent collision between a rising world population and a shrinking world water resource, global warming. In a grim first interview in the climate change debate, the defense secretary issued a bleak forecast that violence and political conflict would become more likely in the next 20 to 30 years as climate change turned land into desert and melted ice fields and poisoned water supplies. Climate campaigners echoed Reid's warning and demanded that ministers redouble their efforts to curb carbon emissions. Reid signaled Britain's armed forces would have to be prepared to tackle conflicts over dwindling resources. Military planners have already started considering the potential impact of global warming for Britain's armed forces over the next 20 to 30 years. They accept some climate change is inevitable and warn Britain must be prepared for humanitarian disaster relief, peacekeeping, and warfare to deal with the dramatic social and political consequences of climate change. Reid warned of increasing uncertainty about the future of countries least well-equipped to deal with flooding, water shortages, and valuable agricultural land turning to desert. He said climate change was already a contributing factor in conflicts in Africa, this according to The Independent.
That's the Cable Morning News for Wednesday, March 1st, 2006. Weather for today calls for showers with temperatures in the low 50s. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Boone Rivas. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Stay tuned. At 7:30, Parafagrin hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. At 9, the KBOO Bike Show will interview local bike tour organizers, and Sarah will give an update on the state of New York City critical mass. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller and guests will speak about the recent WTO interim ruling on the U.S.-EU dispute over genetically modified organisms. At 10:30, I'll be hosting an update on the current situation regarding the rights of immigrants in the U.S. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, followed by Free Speech Radio News. At 6, Circle A Radio will speak with anti-nuclear activists past and present to answer the question, whatever happened to the nuclear movement? They will also discuss the Bush administration's push towards expanded nuclear weapons manufacturing and the controversial storage proposal for the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste site in Nevada. That's all right here on KBOO, your community, non-corporate, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is the community calendar for Wednesday, March 1st, and welcome to the first day of March. This means we're only 19 days away from the first day of spring. Please join the City Council for the Citywide Community Budget Forum tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. to participate in an open discussion about your priorities for next year's city budget. The event will be held at the City Council Chambers at City Hall, and that address is 1220 Southwest 4th Avenue in downtown Portland. Tonight's forum is being held to receive community input regarding priorities for about $18 million available in one-time funding for the next fiscal year. As the school districts will be finalizing their budgets in the coming weeks, the need for a community discussion about the priorities for spending the one-time funds is critical. The forum discussion will also follow a facilitated discussion format. Seating in council chambers is limited, with space for about 150 participants. Community members are reminded that parking meters are enforced until 7 p.m. in the downtown area. For more information, go to the web at portlandonline.com/community budget. The fourth annual Read Across Oregon event, hosted by Oregon Literacy Incorporated, will take place throughout the month of March of 2006. School, libraries, and literacy programs can receive half of the funds that are raised by anyone that they've recruited to participate in Read Across Oregon. It is extremely easy to become involved. Read Across Oregon can be done from anywhere that someone has a book. Participants can read at home, on the bus, in the park, and even to their children, or vice versa, and textbooks do count. For more information, visit the web at OregonLiteracy.org or contact John Turok. That number is 503-244-3898. That's 503-244-3898. If you are a member of a nonprofit or community group and would like to have an upcoming event considered for an announcement on this program, please email the KBOO Community Calendar. That email address is kboocommunitycalendar@gmail.com, or you may post your announcement on our website at kboo.fm. You've been listening to the Community Calendar for KBOO listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.